So hey everybody, it's Tuesday at 4. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. Today we're excited. We're going to have a conversation with Rosemary Molina, and we're going to talk about the car wash campaign, the theft of wages, but more importantly, the question of organizing, predominantly Latino, but a multiracial working class. And we're going to talk about what you can do, because on Voices from the Frontlines, the question is always, what are we going to do about it? We're not a criticism show, we're a strategy show, and we're working with people who are voices from the front lines. I'm also going to do a review of a film I saw called Chappie, which I'm calling a film of racist robotics. And it's not that deep. It's just something I wanted to talk about a little bit about white supremacy and all its manifestations. But the most important conversations can be with Rosemary. So I'm going to start with my review of Chappie. Well, I went to see Chappie, a film by Neil Blomkamp. What could be bad? He made District 9 and Elysium, both of which involved a class warfare led by blacks and Latinos against the white power structure and with strong apartheid, anti-apartheid themes. So, you know, a film with a robot, good politics, escapist. Well, so what the hell happened? Because this turned out to be an exercise in racist robotics. The blurb on Rotten Tomatoes says, describing the film Chappie, quote, "In the near future, crime is patrolled by an oppressive, mechanized police force. But now the people are fighting back. When one police droid, Chappie, is stolen and given new programming, he becomes the first robot with the ability to think and feel for himself. As powerful destructive forces start to see Chappie as a danger to mankind and order, they will stop at nothing to maintain the status quo and assure that Chappie is the last of his kind." So, here's the main problem. The story goes that Chappie, a robot, is programmed by an Indian man, Dev Patel, from the Slumdog Millionaire. He's stolen by two white punk rock drug dealers and thieves, Ninja and Yolandi Visser. Visser spells his name V-I-S-S-E-R with dollar signs with the S. These are well-known rap artists in South Africa. They're white. But through their capture of the disgruntled scientist who birthed the white robot Chappie, played by Charlito Copley, also a white guy, they begin to give him a sentient personality and try to program him morally, that is to say, Dev Patel does. But the other guys are trying to program Chappie to help them steal cars, steal money, because they have to pay back a debt. So is the bad white guy and his bad Latino sidekick, Jose Pablo Cantillo, try to get Chappie to help them steal cars, drugs, and pay back a debt to a black drug dealer. His new white punker mom goes all maternal on him and loves him to death. Then the bad white guys decide to toughen up Chappie and send him off finally to see what the mean outside world is like. They dump him off in front of a black lumpen street gang played with cartoon-like stereotypes. They're cruel, mean, and they try to kill Chappie, almost burning him to death. But Chappie, like a lost dog, finally comes home to his white mommy, and even his new white daddy, who left him to learn how to fight by being by the gang members, starts to soften up on him. So now that the white robot has been beaten by the blacks, the white mommy and daddy and the white robot work to destroy the police state while the blacks riot in the streets. But the white mommy and daddy also take on the other white forces of evil, Hugh Jackman, a competing counterinsurgency expert, and Sigourney Weaver, who gets to play a ruthless white corporate boss who sells robots to put down the black masses. So the film has, in its own terms, a happy ending. The white robot, not to be confused with the white rabbit, goes on a warpath and starts carrying out guerrilla warfare against the other robots, which is supposed to make us happy. And yes, the audience cheers. But this forces the system to go back to using human police, who we hate. But then again, they're all black. So the white robot and his white parents and his Indian maker, the godlike figure, defeat the bad white guy, Hugh Jackman. They defeat the black gang members, the black police, while the black masses riot in the streets for no rhyme or reason. But wait, where do you think this film takes place? In South Africa. You know, black South Africa, in which the black masses fought for an end to apartheid. What does it take for a black African to get a good part in a movie, even in black Africa, even after the revolution? In this film, Chappie, there was not one defined role for a black African and not one hero. Even the damn robot was white. So, folks, what's particularly sad is that this filmmaker creates a film in which people's terror of the technological takeover of society, as they're all texting in the theater in protest, is given hope by a machine that develops a conscience and consciousness, while the tens of millions of black Africans are portrayed as machines with no conscience or no consciousness. Rotten Tomatoes gave this one a 30, a very low grade. I would put it at 30 below zero. I would call for a boycott, but it's really not worth the effort. It will fall of its own weight. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. So I'm in the studio with Rosemarie Molina. She's the strategic director of the Community Labor Environmental Action Network Clean Car Wash Campaign, the Clean Car Wash Campaign. Last month, the California Labor Commissioner's Office did a two-day sweep of Los Angeles car washes. The results showed that almost 400 workers weren't being paid enough under the state wage and hours laws, and they uncovered an estimated $1.3 million in wage theft. Now I'm going to read from a press release. Inner workings of 35 Los Angeles car washes not so clean. A two-day sweep of car wash businesses in the Los Angeles area uncovered 35 businesses that failed to register with the state and an estimated $1.3 million-plus in wage theft, the California Labor Commissioner's office said. The two-day sweep found that nearly 400 workers were not getting paid enough under state wage and hour laws. Violations cited included the failure to pay workers minimum wage and overtime, which resulted in $412,000 in penalties and $308,000 in liquidated damages. An additional 17 violations with citations totaling $218,000 were issued to car washes that did not carry workers' compensation insurance coverage. These citations serve as a reminder that wage theft will not be tolerated. The Labor Commission's office targets its enforcement efforts on employers who intentionally skirt the law, said Christine Baker, director of the Department of Industrial Relations, in a statement. The 35 unregistered car wash businesses reflect a significant drop in registration from 2013 to 2014. When car wash businesses fail to register, it's often an indicator of wage theft, said Labor Commissioner Julie A. Sue in a statement. We want to make sure that car wash workers are paid what they're owed and that employers who follow the law know that we're on their side. All right, that's what they say. Now tell us what's really going on, Rosemarie.
Well, I want to applaud the efforts of Julie Sue, the Labor Commissioner, for taking this matter really seriously. The car wash industry still today in 2015 operates below any basic standards of the law. You can see they're not paying minimum wage. There's a lot of wage theft. They're not paying workman's comp. This is a dangerous industry to be in. And I think the Labor Commissioner is using their powers to try and enforce some of that. But what's really going on is workers are organizing on the ground. The Labor Commissioner does these sweeps as often as possible given their limited capacity, and that happens. They had one last year. There's one this year. But what happens every day? What happens the other 364 days of the year? Workers are out there really enforcing what they know needs to happen. They're doing that by direct action. They're doing that by using policy and creative ways to be able to have better organizing tools. And they're doing that by educating themselves about their rights. And I think it's really important that we give the Labor Commissioner credit, but continue to do the organizing on the ground every other day of the year.
Well, tell us, what's it like for the car wash heroes, for the car wash workers? I mean, what's their daily life like? How do they organize without retaliation? How do they even keep their jobs?
It's tricky. And unfortunately, there's a lot of retaliation. But I can tell you what the day in the life of a car wash worker is. Workers typically get to work about 7 o'clock. A lot of them aren't able to clock in until 10 or 11, are forced to work through any breaks. That's a bathroom break, rest break, meal break. And then they're forced to clock out early and continue to work until about 7 o'clock. You have workers, typical in the industry, workers working for $35 to $50 a day for a 10 to 12-hour day of work. That's far below the minimum wage. You have some workers in other parts of the city working for tips only. That means no wages at all. Wage theft is a very serious problem in the industry, and it's endemic in the industry. You also have workers being threatened when they do try and speak up. You have workers being threatened with ICE, with immigration being called on them, workers being fired on the spot, workers not being able to ask even for a water break out of fear of what could happen, them losing their job. And workers are trying to address that through organizing committees, by educating themselves on, you know, what their basic rights are. And when workers do get fired, we fight back. and we've been very successful in getting workers their jobs back. But the day in the life of a car wash worker is not glamorous, and even organizing is extremely hard. But the risk is worth it because it can't get much worse than that.
In terms of, like, let's say that you're a worker who's mm-hmm. politically conscious and wants to organize, do they work with you?
They do. So we've been very fortunate at the car wash campaign to have workers approach us. They walk into our office. They call us. Car wash workers have a very tight network, and a lot of them come from the same communities in their home countries. So we often get a worker calling us, advising us about an issue that's happening at their car wash and asking, what can they do about it? And it's nice when you get one worker, but a lot of times those workers come already organized. They've already been talking to all of their coworkers. These are their family members. This is the network that they've had for a really long time. So we've been fortunate enough to have one worker call, but eight workers come in and request a meeting. That's a committee already formed. And I think what's interesting about that is that they're most of the time ready to go.
Well, it's interesting because back many years ago in the day, the first organizing that I did was with the Congress of Racial Equality, and I was approached similarly by a group of black and Puerto Rican porters in the Trailways Bus Company. And they had jobs, but they were facing tremendous racial discrimination. And I was approached by this guy, Eddie Barnes, and I said, I don't do individual grievances. I was with CORE. He said, this is not an individual grievance. We have a group of us. And I went to meet with them. And there was like 12, all men, black and Puerto Rican, as you said, led by this guy, Eddie Barnes. They had a whole campaign organized already. They just wanted CORE to support them. At the Bus Riders Union, we haven't had that level of success. We haven't. The people that we found have been individually great people, but they don't have a base. They don't often come to us and say there's six of us who want to do something. So this is a very exciting part of the work. How do you understand the history of this level of self-organization?
A lot of workers have had experiences in their home countries with unions, which has been really nice.
What countries are you
talking
about?
In Central America, in Mexico. We have some workers that come to us prepared, and they more or less get the message, and they know what organizing is, and they're not afraid of it. And then you have other workers who we need to do a lot of leadership development with them. The hardest thing is breaking down the fear and letting them know that, you know, you want to organize, you want to stand up to the boss. There's a very real risk that you're going to lose your livelihood. You're right. Going to lose your job. How is this going to affect your family, especially if you're the only one working and sending money back? But once we get past that and continue leadership development the entire way, let them be the ones that drive the strategy and make the plans, you have better buy-in that way. I think a lot of the I can't even say that word, they become politicized through each other. A lot of times you have workers holding each other accountable, which has been really nice. And I think unity in the group is very key. If people aren't trusting each other with their lives, you're not going to get them to move very far. So all of that takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time, takes a lot of education. And it takes a lot of human heart, I think, to get them to get to that place.
Well, let's talk about, there's two things. One is trade union consciousness in the best sense of that, and the other is a broader political consciousness about changing the whole society. But let's stay with trade union consciousness, not necessarily limiting it. But do these workers come with some prior history? For instance, again, when the Bus Riders Union was begun, we were able to have Ricardo Zalata, who came out of communist movements in Central America. He was working with the Textile Workers Union at the time. Other workers, Rosalie Mendiola was with the PRD in Mexico. He had already been political. The late Pat Elmore came out of a black feminist. She called herself a black feminist Buddhist communist. And she came out of a lot of different traditions. So a lot of the people that originally helped us form the Bus Riders Union were very broadly political conscious. What's the consciousness of the workers who come? Do they come out of any prior history of political activity?
There are a few that do, but I think a lot of our members organize because they have to. It's just survival for them. I think that's why there's a lot of success in this. Things need to get better for them to continue to live, to be able to buy food. You have workers earning no wages or $3 an hour. It's only going to get better if they do something. When workers learn that federal and labor law, federal labor law and state labor law cover them, regardless of their status, that's empowering to them. That's a tool that they use. And I think a lot of it comes out of survival, regardless of if they have a political consciousness when they get to our organization. I know we have one member who was asked in a meeting with some community members, you know, how do you measure your leadership development? And he was taken aback by it a little bit. He didn't really understand it. And then took him a minute and he said, you know, I had to cross three borders to get here. I had to leave my two daughters. I haven't seen them in 10 years. And then I had to come to this country and fight harder than I ever thought to earn a dollar. I wasn't allowed to drink water. I couldn't use the restroom. And the only way this has gotten better is by me taking a stand and talking to my other coworkers and talking to some of my bosses and building relationships. So I don't know how to measure metrically my development, but I know that when I'm different now than when I got here, and I know I'm going to continue to grow. And he even threw in, you know, I'm illiterate and I can run agendas and facilitate meetings. So again, throwing it back, like they're out of survival, they have grown so much. Our workers are very empowered because they have to be to make change.
The voice you're listening to is Rosemary Molina, who's with the Clean Car Wash Campaign. She's also came to the Bus Riders Union at first to sort of reach out to us, in which we've been a big ally of the Car Wash Campaign, calling the Car Wash Shadows. And then she attends every Bus Riders Union meeting for over a couple of years. So we really appreciate that you didn't just come to make a presentation, but you stayed and helped us be part of the movement. One question I've had is, I don't want to underestimate it, but given the relative lack of capital that most of the car wash owners have, why couldn't, like if we had an organizing committee of 100 community supporters, along with a good base inside the group, why couldn't we have more capacity to just force them to settle? And are you trying to get contracts, which I'm sure you realize is another question? Is one of the goals to simply get the labor standards enforced, or is there the goal to get an actual contract?
It depends on what the workers want to do. Sometimes at a car wash, workers will decide that having a union contract is the best strategy. And when that's the case, that's the route that we go. But it comes from them. We don't just go into a shop and say, we're going to have a union here. They really have to believe in that because it's a hard fight and it's a very long fight. And if you want somebody to be there for 5 years, they have to believe in it wholeheartedly. The reason why a union contract has functioned so well is because it puts basic standards in writing in a way that the workers can enforce immediately and every day. It gives them an immediate voice on the job. They don't have to go through litigation for that. They can, whatever they put in writing is something that's going to stay there, and they become the officers of that, right, which is really great. It's a very empowering experience. So when that happens, that's fantastic. Other times, workers just want to fix a health and safety issue at their shop.
Right.
We still consider that a union car wash. Those workers are united in the same way as union work members would be. They just don't have a contract on paper. Sometimes they just want to do a delegation to management and the issue gets resolved. It really depends on the workers and the case that they want. I think one of our main goals is to empower workers, to keep developing our worker leadership, to grow as much as we can. Union organizing is a very small component of what we do. We've opened a worker center, and that worker center is where a lot of these are workers who've been with us for 4 or 5 years. Some of them have won union contracts, some of them haven't, some of them have lost union campaigns, and they're still there. And they identified a need from our membership base for basic services. And so they're developing their leadership in that capacity. We have other members who want to work on solidarity work. They want to be at other people's actions. They want to go to the grocery workers boycott. They want to go to the bus rider union meetings. And so I think empowering them to be leaders, not just in their union, in their car wash, in the union, but to be leaders in the community is really big for us. That's going to take them farther in life than anything else.
Again, this is a conversation with a very fine organizer, Rosemary Molina, in a movement that's generated some very fine worker organizers and worker leaders. And at a certain point, we're going to ask for your help. We're going to ask for things that you can do, which we're going to get to fairly soon. So back to you, Rosemary, a couple more questions. Now let's go back to the question I was asking about community pressure, labor community coalitions.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked at the General Motors factory at I worked at three. I worked at the Ford Milpitas factory, and then I worked at the General Motors Southgate factory, and then I worked at General Motors Van Nuys plant. General Motors was threatening to close up plants. They had closed down plants all over the United States. And I had come out of the civil rights movement. I had come out of a different tradition besides the trade union tradition. And I didn't come up with this idea of a labor community coalition to keep Van Nuys open. But the way that it developed, I'm going to come to this, is that when I went to the president of my union, Pete Beltran, I said, Pete, we have to build this movement against General Motors. First of all, he did kind of laugh and said, you're not going to get General Motors to do what you want because we can't go on strike. If we go on strike, they don't even want us. So they don't even want our labor, which is why they want to close the plant. He says, plus, read the contract. And the contract clearly stated General Motors had the power to pretty much do whatever it wanted to. And it certainly had the power to open and close the plant. The workers had no say in this. So I said to Pete, well, I understand they have the legal right to close it. But what if we build a political movement that convinces them not to exercise that right? Because it's still a political and economic decision on their part. So they have the right to close it, but we have a right to build this movement. And Pete says, well, actually, we don't. Because under the contract, we also can boycott our own company. I said, darn. I mean, so, we started thinking it through. I said, all right, well, who can boycott? And he said, well, Cesar Chavez can boycott. The black community can boycott. So we said, wait a minute. All right, so we get it. We as workers can go out and get other people to put pressure on General Motors in support of us. And so we formed a separate organization called the Labor Community Coalition to keep GM Van Nuys open, of which I was the director. And I was also a worker in the factory. And through an amazing campaign over about 3 or 4 years, we put so much pressure on General Motors in Los Angeles that we were able to keep that plant open. It's a long story. There's a book I wrote called Taking on General Motors, and there's a great film called Tiger by the Tail about this movement. Now, bring it back to the car wash shadows. What's been the highest level of community pressure on, like, are there car wash owners who have 3 car washes or 6 car washes? Is there perhaps a high-visibility bad actor who has a lot of employees and therefore a victory? What's been some of the ideas about the relationship between building a base inside the factory and community pressure on the car wash itself?
So community organizing is a huge part of the Clean Car Wash campaign, and that's something that I've focused on the past 3 and 4 years. We know that we are stronger together, and we actively reach out to community to create this second arm for our campaign. We actually have a community advisory board that is comprised of over 20 organizations in Los Angeles. And we have meetings every month to talk about strategy that would go along with whatever the worker strategy on the ground is at that time. Workers love this part of the campaign because it means they're not alone. It means that when they go do a letter drop to demand that they have water, to demand that they have health and safety equipment and fair wages, or even minimum wage, right, that there are community allies that are going to walk with them and stand behind them and tell the owner that they're not in this alone. And these people are from their neighborhoods. They're going to go to that car wash, so it creates a lot of pressure. We've had picket lines where only 5 workers were able to get out and go on the picket line, and some of them were fired, but we've had 150 community members there walking that picket line with the workers. That's how we've won. Now, there you have some car washes that some owners that have 3 car washes or 6 car washes, but it's not very common. And those are usually the bigger car washes with a lot more resources tied to a lot more assets outside of the industry. So with those campaigns, we've had to get really creative. I can use the example of the Sictors, who are now signatories. Thank you for respecting your workers' rights. But in that fight, we had to, the workers decided to file a lawsuit, which was, I think it was up to $13 million at its high point. We had a lot of community activity supporting the workers, and we knew that that owner also owned a restaurant in Hollywood, so that became a target of us, of ours. And we only were successful in that campaign because of the workers' strength and the community's strength to stand behind them for 2 years on something that solid. We have community members coming out to our picket lines, doing delegation drops, some even coming up to Sacramento with us when we were trying to pass state legislation, and the roots just run really deep. We, I think it's really amazing what we've been able to do and to build our campaign for so many years in a hybrid way where it's not just worker organizing, but the same amount of effort and focus is also put into building coalitions and alliances. It's about sharing resources also. So we're not just taking from our community allies, we're giving back. We're going to the same events that they need us to be at. We're also going up to Sacramento for their issues. And we're creating these really deep relationships between workers when they get to hear other people in the city and other industries going through the same thing as they are.
This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. And this is fun for me because we like talking to real organizers. I mean, one of the things that I'm just realizing is we really have lost a lot of the organizing tradition in the movement. There's a lot more activism as opposed to organizing. There's not a lot of people who are building very deep roots, who are trying to build leadership of working class people, building structures of resistance. And I'm going to get to some questions in a minute with Rosemarie about the difficulty of sustaining groups, the and contradictions within groups, you know. But these are the things that organizers love to talk about, because publicly we're always telling everybody all the good things we're doing, because it's true, it's absolutely true. But then when we organizers get together, it's always, how do you keep the members together, and how do you avoid drop-off, and how do you avoid the conflicts within the group? And it's a very problem-solving culture. It's not in any way, it's a very optimistic culture, but it is a very materialist, honest. Organizers are not generally boastful because they're just trying to win. And so among themselves, there's, in fact, I've always found a very introspective, worried type of mentality. You know, like, I'm worried about this and I'm worried about that, in the good sense of the word. So I've gotten to know Rosemarie, and I really have a lot of respect for the work you've done. So in terms of our listeners on KPFK, 90.7 FM, in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. And oh, by the way, I actually got some great emails last week and didn't bring them to read. So I owe you guys next week. But several of the people called in, and I am going to see on the break if I can get Stan and some people to just take a few calls, because I would like, in the last 10 minutes, in particular, if you've ever... for you to be able to talk with Rosemarie about the work. But if you could send me emails at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. I got some great emails, including this brother who was discussing the work. And we said, please call and let us get in touch with you. He did. Another person said, hey, listen, I've been listening, and I think I want to become an organizer. What should I do? So we've been getting some very thoughtful, and I've read some in the past, and I promise I'll bring them next week. So, this is Voices from the Frontlines. We call it your national movement building show. We have people all over the country listening live, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. We also have a lot of you who've been going up on our website, www.voicesfromthefrontlines, and downloading the show. And you can also podcast the show. I don't know how, but I'm told you can. And we're going to go to the phones in about 10 minutes at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, especially those of you who are out there in any way trying to do any kind of organizing, including organizers from the Strategy Center and other people doing work who want to talk to Rosemarie about some real problems in the organizing process. And I want to make sure we move now, Rosemarie, to the question of what can people do to help. We're going to come back to some other problems, but I want to make sure, is there a, like, for instance, you just got a good ruling from the Labor Commission. If somebody's called you now and said, what do you want me to do? I'm a community resident. I'm at a university. I'm in a church. How do I help you win these campaigns? What would you answer?
I would, well, there are some immediate things we can do. I would tell them to join us on the picket line on Saturday. We have a group of workers who came to us, one of those miracle instances where they came to us organized, talking about severe wage theft. And they approached the owner, and he said, I'm going to handle it. I'll pay you back immediately, and then the next day the car wash shut down. This was about 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
Car wash reopened two days later.
Are you allowed to say your name?
I can't, and so I will give you our email after. If you'd like information on the picket, I can send you that. We don't want to alert them.
Okay. But well, what is the email that you want people to
do? If people can email cleancarwashla@gmail.com, that's CLEAN carwashla @gmail.com. I will email you right back.
Okay.
That is our campaign email. But these workers, a new owner came in 2 days later and opened up shop. And by California law, he's responsible for the wage theft committed by the previous owner. When you go into business, you should know what you're getting yourself into. And he is being very unresponsive to the workers. He hired back the full workforce except the 5 workers that stood up for themselves.
Right.
And these workers still have not been paid. And they're owed quite a bit of money, and it's completely unfair. This is another example of how wage theft is happening right under our noses in 2015, if you can believe it or not. And you can help by being on the picket line from 10 to 1 on Saturday. If you can give up your Saturday for a few hours, you're helping the lives of workers that really need the support right now. And again, that email is cleancarwashla@gmail.com, and I will personally answer that email.
You know that the Bus Riders Union has its meeting Saturday, and we're going to be doing some work on taking up on some auto companies, because we have this campaign called No Cars in LA,
mm-hmm.
and we're trying to develop a consciousness around either people not using cars or making demands on car dealerships to not sell SUVs and to not sell some of the big trucks. We can't really yet demand that they don't sell cars, but we're going to start our first effort to talk to some people about, so how do you feel about climate change, and how do you feel about global warming, and are you willing to make some changes, including demanding free public transportation, getting out of your car altogether, but also restrictions on the auto, auto-free zones, auto-free days, and are you willing to go into this dealership today and say, gee, I never was thinking about that, but I just met the Fight for the Soul of the Cities, and they're saying we shouldn't even have cars. So I want to at least talk to you about mileage. And I'm starting to think that maybe those expensive cars you want me to buy are not the ones I'm going to buy. Or they even asked me to suggest to hold off buying something for a year, since I already have a car. So we're just experimenting with this. But what I'm getting to, because you know I wouldn't just talk about this, is we're going to send some people to the other action as well. That's my point. I never ask people, what do you want to help, and say, well, best of luck to you. I'm going to go do this other thing. So I was getting to the fact that we have a bus riders union meeting this Saturday at 10, and Barbara Lott Holland and I are the co-chairs of the bus riders union. I'm now going to say, well, I had this person who we know, Rosemary Molina, who comes to all our meetings, and they're having a very important picket on Saturday, and I'm excited about that. So we will... You can count on us. We're going to divide up our troops,
mm-hmm.
and we have our meeting at 10. And then at 11, some people go and deal with the car wash, and some people will deal with the cars. How's that?
That sounds great.
So,
thank you.
I can make that commitment already. So you're getting some people from being on the show. See? Got us.
Thank you.
818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. If you want to talk about how to help the car wash movement, if you want to ask Rosemary about questions about organizing, if you want to come out either to work with the, I won't announce the Bus Riders Union thing either Saturday, because I'm not telling them where we're going either. But I want to focus on helping the car wash movement today. So 818-985-5735 if you want to talk to Rosemary and Eric. If not, we're going to have a good old time and keep talking. So again, stands ready to be at the phones. You guys have been very, very good. The subject is wage theft. The subject is immigrant workers, which we want to talk about. The subject is capitalism. And the subject especially is building worker organization. So is it cleancarwashla@gmail.com?
Mm-hmm.
Did I get it right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not good at these. cleancarwashla@gmail.com, and Rosemary will answer you personally. 818-985-5735. We already got a couple of callers, which is great. I'm going to ask Rosemary one more question, and then we're going to go to the phones, because I love going to the phones. Let us know who's out there. Remember, again, emails to Eric@voicesfromthefrontlines, emails to cleancarwashcampaignla@gmail.com. So Rosemary, take us inside the movement, and one of the problems we know is the owners know that given the tremendous pressure on people, waiting people out is one of their biggest tactics, right? Stalling workers come in with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm at first and fear. Let's talk about those 5 workers who've been fired. What can we do to help them? Let's talk. That's an important thing. How do we? Because we know that there are leaders of movements. We believe in leadership. so do the owners believe in leadership, which is why they try to get rid of them. So I remember when you and I were just talking informally, you called it having a target on your back, and that the leaders of the movement always go to work every morning with a target on their back. Tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing to try to build leadership, protect leadership, and what do you do when they retaliate against leadership?
I think it's important on how we start. A lot of times workers come to us really fired up, and they want to immediately strike, and we have to let them know that that's an option, and they have every right to do that. But there are a lot of repercussions, and there might be a better strategy. So what we like to do is use our past experience and maybe have other workers talk to them about all of the options that are on the table for them. We also are very, very real about the time that it takes when you want to organize. Are you willing to hang in there for 5 years? That's very real. And make sure that they understand the risk, that they understand the full totality of the risk of wanting to organize. And once we get past that, I think we can move forward to the next steps. It's really hard to get people to stay on a campaign for 3 years. What we have to focus on is reminding people that they have the power. And so doing direct action is one of those things. Even if there's a lull in the campaign, and for that particular week, the owner's being really nice and there's no retaliation, there's nothing bad happening, that doesn't mean you don't flex your power as workers and remind the owner that it doesn't matter. We hold the cards in our hand. So sometimes we do really fun creative actions, like the workers will bring in a Viva la Union cake and they'll share it with all their coworkers. That helps to keep the power and the morale going. Or everybody will decide to button up one day or wear their committee t-shirt that day. There's little things that we do to keep the morale going. But I think having the workers understand from the very beginning what they're getting themselves into and that they have the power throughout the entire process helps to make organizing a little easier. But organizing's hard, no matter how you look at it.
It's very hard. I'm going to go because I want to hear. We have a call from Carlos in Carson. You're on the line with Rosemary Molina as the main person you're going to talk to, and Eric Mann. Hey, Carlos, what's up?
Just a question here. Regarding the labor force, Ms. Molina, what impact does the large influx of population of people coming into the United States, what impact does that have on compression of wages? Is there a core relationship? And also the fact that owners know there's a surplus amount of labor out there because of all these millions of people coming in. So they use that, I guess, in a way to exploit theft of wages from laborers.
Very good question. That's obviously a problem, Rosemary.
So that is a good question. Actually, numbers of people coming into the country have been on a steady decline in the past few years. And the average car wash worker in L.A. has lived here for at least 7 years. So I know that a lot of people think that these are very recent immigrants working in the car wash industry, but actually they're not. They've been here. They've had some stability here in L.A. for a while. So that's been interesting. But I think you're very right that owners know how to exploit a surplus in labor. They know how to exploit somebody who might not have stable immigration status, and they use that against them. But once workers understand that the law applies to them no matter what, that they should be earning the minimum wage regardless of their status, I think that's kind of a breakthrough point we have. But one of the trickiest things we have to deal with, and Carlos kind of touched on this, is that fear of knowing that you can always be replaced. And once you can get through that with a worker, I think the organizing becomes a little bit easier.
818-985-5735. We have one call. This is anonymous. I think you need to give your name if you're going to be on the show. But let me say a couple of things that I want to say. I think the using in some way blaming immigrants by saying you're creating a labor surplus, you know, that you're creating it, you're making it easier for the employer, I think it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, there's always somebody unemployed. Mm-hmm. The capitalism calls it the reserve army of the unemployed. Whether it's immigrants or not immigrants, we have all kinds of unemployment. You know, there's 50% unemployment in the black community today. There's massive unemployment and low-wage employment. There's people getting laid off. So any worker who is going to stand up is not mainly going to get fired because there's somebody outside who wants their job. They're going to get fired because they're organizing. And so I don't like that. You know, it's an implied critique that, well, if we could, maybe what's the answer, cutting off immigration? No, that's not the problem. The problem is capitalism, not the workers. So I just wanted to support that. 818-985-5735 if you want to talk to Rosemarie. I am going to take the call. And if anonymous, I hope you're going to be a very nice person. Let's see what's happening. Whoever you are.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Okay, yeah. I have a hearing impaired brother who was working at a car wash on Sunset Boulevard for over 30 years. He's hearing impaired, and he has autism. And he was let go. I don't know why, but I know there was a lot of waste there. And then I noticed that the other day I was looking at his check stub, and they have put in his wrong social security number. So when they let him go, I was going to go take him to the UCLA Labor Center
right. So
we can fight for his job somehow. But my brother says he doesn't understand anything. He doesn't even understand Spanish, to be honest. So I did not do anything. But he got another job where the same thing is happening to him. Wage theft. Now they have him, like, he'll go, like, in the morning thinking he's going to go into work, but they say no, coming at 11. So he practically spends all day long just trying to get 8 hours of work. And they say sometimes they tell him, oh, come in on this day at these hours, and they said, no, you have to wait 2 more hours to come into work. Like that, he has to have set hours.
That's highly illegal, and unfortunately, it's really common in the car wash industry. I think the UCLA Labor Center is a great place to go. They have clinics on Tuesdays and Thursdays to deal with wage theft. But if you'd like, you can email me at cleancarwashla@gmail.com, and maybe we can talk to you a little further offline about what we can do. I'm really sorry this is happening to your brother. It's way too common in this industry. One of the things you can do is help him file a wage claim with the Division of Labor Standards Enforcement, DLSE, but you should know up front that the waiting time to even get a hearing is 495 days. So sometimes we have to think really critically about all of our options.
And another reason why I did not resort to UCLA Labor Center is because I was afraid he wouldn't be able to get another job. Since my brother is very, you know, he cannot really do a lot of work, a lot of other trades. That's all he knows. So I was like, he'll never get another job. He resorts to a legal procedure.
Well, the other option is you can maybe have him apply for work at a union car wash. There are 35 union car washes in the area, and if you go to our website, cleancarwashcampaign.org, we have a map and a list of some of those. That might be a good place to start. Those are good employers.
So if I email you what was the email?
Clean Car Wash Campaign.
CleanCarWashCampaign.org.
Well, that's the website. If you want to take a look at the car washes, we don't have any on Sunset. Most of them are in South LA. And the email is cleancarwashla@gmail.com.
Okay, so I'm going to email you, okay?
Okay.
So because I really want that desperate, those car washes that have union, because my brother's just being robbed. I'm basically subsidizing his living expenses.
Well, I want to say that I want to apologize that when I saw Anonymous, because we've had, how can I put it, we've had some listeners who just are weird, you know, and when
no,
I
that's
see...
Okay. Well,
no, brother, wait, I'm apologizing to you.
To your program.
No, listen, I was apologizing to you that you were being anonymous because of wanting to protect your status and protect your brother, and I'm apologizing. When I saw the word anonymous, it didn't register to me why you wanted that. So the main thing is, please get in touch with Rosemarie. Please send that email. She's very good at answering emails to cleancarwashla@gmail.com. You're exactly the kind of people that we want to be calling Voices from the Front Lines. This is, brother, we're so happy that you called. So thank you so much. And I want to be able to take one more. Megan?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, brother. Megan, how are you? Stan, she's still there? Let's see if she's around, and if not, we'll go back to Rosemarie. All right, don't think we can find her. 818-985-5735. We only have about 3 more minutes. Somebody once came to me at the Strategy Center and said, I'd like to be an organizer with you. What's the minimum amount of time that you think is worth doing? And I said, 5 years. I said, because in 5 years, you can make something happen. In this field, anything less than that, I can't promise you anything because we do campaigns. We're not a social worker. So it takes time to build an organization, time to build a tactical plan. So the fact that you were willing to say to workers, which I just really admire, to say to them, because you're really saying capitalism is not a good system. It's not like you're just going to show up and you don't have rights in the classic sense. You don't have rights that you can exercise without power. How do you think they respond? Not how do they respond when you tell them that?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think some workers really get it, and they understand that it's going to be better in the long haul. These car wash workers are in it for a career. These aren't transitional jobs. They're there because that's their profession, and they're going to be there until the end. So for a lot of them, 5 years might seem like a lot, but they know that the other 30 years are going to be smooth sailing because they're going to have some type of power established. They're going to have some type of unity established in the workplace. And then other workers, I think they're, it takes them a while to register that this process isn't going to be over with one picket line. It's not going to be over with a strike or one letter drop. You really have to put in work and do a lot of waiting time and think comprehensively about these campaigns. It's not just one direct action. It's a direct action, building a community network, possibly file wage claims, file a lawsuit, talk to the churches in the area, do labor in the pulpit. It's this huge bubble. It's multiple bubbles of pressure we have to put on the owner. And I think the more workers learn about that, they make informed decisions on what route they want to go.
I think you're very big on the concept of informed decisions, and I just would like to add that for a lot of working people, if they begin to understand that this is a campaign, it's not just about me, that you're asking me already to change society in some way, then 5 years doesn't seem like I'm just waiting 5 years to get something better in my life. But we can start enjoying it now, because if you like organizing, if you like fighting, if you like strategy or tactics, then it's not like you're going to do nothing and then 5 years later. If you're going to have actions, you're going to have educational programs, you're going to meet new relationships, you're going to have a birthday cake with a union sign on it. You're going to have. So I think if we bring the joy of organizing to the working class, then rather than picturing it 5 years and then I get something, I would argue you're going to get something the first day you get involved.
I think there's two interesting things that I've seen. So one is that we have workers that understand that they have the power immediately once they come together and they stay together. And even though it's going to take them 3 to 5 years to win, they start exercising that right away.
That's right.
So they'll call us and say, hey, we decided to have a strike. We weighed all the options. We understand the risk. There's 13 of us out right now. Can you come and bring us some picket signs? We have one particular committee that's done that a few times, and that's amazing. They understand it. They're organized. They're better organizers than any of us are. And then you have this other angle where what happens after they win? And we have workers coming back wanting to get involved with helping other car wash workers set up their own picket lines, helping other workers across the city do solidarity actions. And some workers saying, I want to open a worker center. So I think it's really interesting to continue to cultivate organizing after wins.
Well, folks, this was Organizing 101, 201, 301, and 401, and the Graduate Seminar. You are listening to Rosemarie Molina, Eric Mann at the Labor Community Strategy Center, and the host of Voices from the Frontlines. I want to thank G, as always. I want to thank Stan for being on the phones. It means a lot. I want to thank, in particular, the two people that called in who really are coming out of the base and who are really concerned. We'll see you next week. I'd love to hear your response both to the film review of Chappie and, much more importantly, to this work. So take good care. Eric at Voices from the Frontlines. We'll see you next week.